A preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. So this evening we are on part two of step one. Last week we covered, for the six people who trudged through the snow to come here, we did the first part, the physical allergy, and tonight we're going to primarily center the discussion around the second part of step one, the obsession of the mind. So that's what's on for tonight. I will read the paragraph on the page, and then our panel will share for a few minutes. If you could welcome Jason and Nicole.
Great. Hi, Jason.
So step one says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. I'm going to start on page five. This is from Bill's story. I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw that I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way, and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Renewing my resolve, I tried again. Some time passed, and confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I have what it takes. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time. But I might as well get good and drunk then. And I did.
Jason, alcoholic.
So that relates to me. I mean, there was many times where I said, you know, I'm not going to do it. There's no way I can have a drink today. And I mean, whether it's through having the DTs at lunch, trying to eat and bringing your plate up to your mouth, or just the fact that the sickness or calling in every Monday. But I made that resolve, like, hey, I'm not going to drink when I get home. And then as soon as I walk in that door, I'm walking right in the basement and pouring a drink before I even know it and taking that first sip, and everything just goes away. And I would say, wow, I told myself I wasn't going to drink tonight. And then there I am. And then one drink, two drink, three drink, four, and so on and so on. And I'd be like, okay, well, I'll just start again tomorrow. And then tomorrow would come, and it would just keep replaying in my head. And not at once did I think I had a mental problem or a mental obsession. I was just like, okay. And then at the age of 32, I came to the conclusion that, you know, I couldn't stop the drinking. And I was ready to die. I was ready to die for it. I figured that it was alcoholism runs in my family. I was like, well, I'll have an alcoholic death. Maybe then, however long I last, maybe those years will be beautiful years. But, you know, nothing about alcoholism is beautiful. I mean, come to terms with realize that, but more and more I would make that promise to myself of not drinking, and that I would not, and it would be a painful fight in my head if I really tried to, or the nights where, you know, I would have one, and then all of a sudden I'd be shaken and DTing in bed, and I'd have to go down and do a shot, right? I have to. It just made my body feel calm, made all the pain go away, but not once until I came in here did I feel like then there was no mental obsession. But yeah, there was the time from the time I got to work to the time I left work, I'm like, okay, well, at least I'll be able to have this clarity once I get home. And once I had that first drink of getting in the basement, everything was fine. Thanks.
Thanks, Jason. Thank you.
Such an appalling lack of perspective. Was I crazy? You know, I think it talks about that insanity being an appalling lack of perspective. And that's what I have. And I wish I could say that I stopped drinking and that went away. But it didn't. I can tell you some stories about this in sobriety as well. But when I was drinking, I started drinking when I was 16. And I had that experience that Bill describes. I had a lot, you know, I had arrived. I was a part of life at last. There was laughter and conviviality. I enjoyed, you know, everything about my life. And it was 8 o'clock in the morning. You know, I when I started drinking, I started drinking. You know, there's no like, oh, let's have a drink and do this. Like, it's just, let's have a drink and then, you know, we'll end up in North Carolina. Who knows? And that's what happened. And I got blackout drunk, you know, from drinking Zima, of all things. I'm embarrassed, you know. I'm such a low-class drunk, you know. As hard as I try to be classy and sophisticated, I can't. But this is talking about the end of the drinking, you know, the end of my drinking. What was that like? And that was awful, you know. That was me being a college student. I was 20 years old, 19, almost 20, and thinking, I shouldn't drink today. You know, I feel like shit. You know, or waking up and going, okay, where am I? I know, wait a minute, I think I recognize those beds. I think I know where I am. And waking up and going, why is my face sticky? What is that? And realizing it was dominant, you know. And I was sexy. You know, I was hot stuff. And I can remember I would walk around my college campus, which was beautiful, by the way, a little small liberal arts college down in South Carolina. And I would get plastic cups, and I would buy bottles of Riuniti Lambrusco. Maybe some of you remember in the 80s these little commercials where they would come on and say, Riuniti on ice, so nice. Isn't that nice? There's nothing nice about that, okay? It's bad. I think it cost $2.99 a bottle then, and I think it cost $3.99 a bottle now. It's been a long time since I had some. And I would walk around campus, and I would be drinking, and I would be crying. And I would think, those girls over there, we don't even know what is going on here. And they were on their way to class. And I'm shit-faced drunk at, you know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, thinking these girls got no idea what's going on. And I couldn't even go to class anymore. I couldn't go to class. And I wasn't taking hard classes. I was taking badminton. German fiddle. Weaving. Like, I was an art student. I was not, you know, involved in, like, you know, physics or even something as hard as political science. And, you know, I had to drop out of badminton because I couldn't do it, you know. Drinking was more important. And it didn't matter that I was disappointing my family and I was running up my credit cards and that I couldn't show up for life, you know, and I tried to stop. And I experienced a little pause the summer before my third year of college, was just put it that way. I don't know. It's probably still freshman. And I stopped for a little while, and I got to school, and someone handed me something, and I took it. And before you knew it, I'm in it again, you know. I don't think about it. I don't think about my family. I don't think about my sister. I don't think about my future. I just think about the relief I'm going to get when I drink. And the insanity is that I think this time it's going to be different. I think I can control it. I think that I'll be able to have just a couple. And as soon as that warmth comes, I think Bill's way classier than I was. He says something like, where was my resolve? I just say F it. And I'm on, you know, it's on. I'm not, you know, they're so classy in this book. And I keep going, you know. And that's crazy. You know, by any definition, that's crazy. And that's what I am, what I'm drinking.
Thanks. We're going to keep going on Bill's story on page 7. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly, even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. But it was not, for the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital. This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end with heart failure during delirium tremens, or I would develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year. She would soon have to give me over to the undertaker or the asylum. Jason?
So for me, I had this classification of what an alcoholic looked like. It was the guy standing in front of the ABC store asking for money, and how bad for him that I can go in there and get liquor and he can't. Kind of rub it in and show him my black bag on the way out. But it was, even when the Coast Guard told me, you know, we think you have a problem, I still was blind to that and was like, maybe you guys have a problem getting in my personal space. That's why you keep saying I smell like alcohol. Back up a little bit. So this guy got a candle warmer and a candle and was trying to scent and blow the scent of the candle warmer to everyone else in the office. But I mean, I look back at it now and it was probably one of the tall-tale signs of them knowing that something was up. But then went to rehab, and even in rehab, I thought it was just, you know, go to rehab, do what they ask, and 28 days later, I'll be able to start with a clean slate, you know, go back out and go drinking and just be that social drinker that everyone else can be without having to finish so much. And then as time went by there, I when I first checked in rehab, they did all these tests, and then they tell you how shot your liver is and all that stuff. So, I mean, that scared me into some, but I figured, okay, this is going to be a vacation from work, from life, from family, just 28 days to sit in a rehab facility. So even being as ignorant as I am, I took that, and Friday that they told me they were going to give me a ride up there, I got completely and utterly annihilated and somehow made it to meet them for the ride up there, but don't remember much of it. I packed some clothes, and I thought it was going to be like this vacation spot with pools, you know, ponies, everything peaceful. So I packed for the ultimate vacation. So I checked in on a Friday and was so wasted that I didn't get the suit I actually packed until Saturday, and come to find out I had 9 bathing suits with me and no other real clothes, and there wasn't one goddamn pool at this place. But it was great. It was that mindset thinking of I wanted to get what I wanted to get, and I had this fantasy in my head of what this looked like, what an alcoholic looked like, until actually just sitting down and understanding, because like I said, I both my parents are active alcoholics, so I saw what their alcoholism looked like, and I said, you know, I'm not an alcoholic because I don't drink beer. I drink vodka. You know, I'm not an alcoholic because I don't beat my wife or anything like that, get in fights, get thrown out of places, fall off bridges. I classified myself as all that. I'm not But I was just, I think I was just doing with playing the blame game and not trying to take responsibility on myself. And until I did, even through rehab, I thought was just, you know, show them that you're making an effort and everything will be okay. But for me, it was even that mind game through rehab where I kept thinking they owed me something out of it. I didn't owe them anything. Thanks.
Thanks, Nicole.
Thank you.
Self-knowledge. So now that you've got the picture of me walking around the beautiful university drinking cheap red wine out of big plastic cups all day, what happened after that was I went to the dean of students of the school and I said, I have a problem. I think I probably whispered it. I always whisper whenever I have to tell the truth. I'm always like, I smoked pot. So I met with her and I said, you know, I had a problem. And she said, okay, why don't you go withdraw from your classes and we'll call your parents. And so I did that. And I'm kind of the opposite of you. I withdrew from all my classes, was preparing to call my parents, and did not comprehend that I was actually leaving the university. Like, I didn't pack. I didn't get ready to leave. I just called my parents. And, you know, she talked to them, and they said, okay, it was around 8 o'clock in the morning. I'm sure that was a lovely phone call for them to get. And they said, your sister will be at the airport at 12:30. You need to be there to meet her. She's bringing you home. So I had to pack really quick. So I just gave away, like, all this stuff. I threw everything in my car, and I drove to, you know, to Charlotte. And my sister came to pick me up. And for 6 hours, she yelled at me until I got home. And I was like, I can just lay off. Like, I cannot deal with this right now. Can't we just listen to some Ben Folds and chill? Like, you don't understand how hard this is for me right now. Like, I have no thought of anyone but myself. And when I got home, my parents said, get in the car. And I said, well, I need to use the bathroom. They said, we don't care, get in the car. And they took me to detox. And they put, you know, and I go to detox. And then I go to intensive outpatient therapy. And I have every kind of friggin' doctor in the world. I got psychiatrists, I got psychologists, I got licensed clinical social workers, I got group therapy, I got family therapy, I got AA meetings, I got NA meetings. I don't know what is going on, but I am busy. And I'm going to my grandmother's house every day and eating Waffle Crisp cereal and drinking sweet tea and eating 2 boxes of lemon heads a day. And going to the AA meeting and drinking coffee that's like white with sugar. And I hate you. Like, I would come to the meetings and I would yell at people and tell them to kiss my ass, and they'd say, keep coming back, and I'd say, come out of here. And the reason I bring this up is because self-knowledge for me began in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that sounds insane, but you can come to Alcoholics Anonymous for a really long time and not really do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did, okay? So I was on a journey to get my life together, and I thought self-knowledge was the answer, and that if I acquired all of the things that I saw that you had, I would be okay. I was still matching my insides to your outsides and trying to make it all good. And when you go to AA meetings, you start to hear people say things like, let go and let God. So I'd come to the meetings and they'd say, I'm so scared. And they'd say, well, just let go and let God. And I had no idea what that meant, but I'd heard it, you know. Just act as if, you know, fake it till you make it. That was a good one. Think. All I could do was think. But I couldn't, like, tell anybody that, because I've been in AA now. I need to know what's going on. And that's what I did until the day came when I couldn't do that anymore. And then I just started smoking weed and going to AA. I don't recommend that either. But it brought me to my knees. Because when you have an alcoholic mind like mine, And I'm going to meetings and leaving to get high and telling everyone I'm sober, like driving up to Richmond and speaking, like at the hospital, at the treatment center, like, I'm great, and going and getting high. I mean, I'm like the poster card for what not to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And finally the day came where I couldn't do that anymore, and my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous started. But I lived on fear and fellowship and self-knowledge for 6 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is painful. It's very painful. I can give you a lot of details about that if you're interested. It's not ready. See, there's the
truth. All right, we're gonna continue on page 24. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into our mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove.
Jason.
Wow. I can't tell you how many times I called into work and used the same excuse for like different duty stations of getting jumped. I was probably jumped once a week. Even on vacations, I got jumped somehow, some way, and came home with a broken nose, eye socket, or something, concussion, fist, and I would just lie about it. Trip to Seattle, I'm TDY, and I got jumped. Got in a fist fight with my spouse, and we went fist for fist, and security showed up about an hour later, and we both passed out at that point, and I go answer the door with blood running down my face. Well, it was dry at this point, so. And then the security in the Seattle Police Department are like, everything okay in there? Oh, yeah, I tripped coming to the door. Meanwhile, I smashed the TV, punched a hole in the wall, and threw everything around. So they're like, okay. So nothing's funner than getting kicked out of a hotel at 2 o'clock in the morning. But, and then having to go check into a hotel. And, you know, you get up in the morning and, you know, you say you're sorry because you mean it this time. And what's the first thing you do? Mix some vodka with Gatorade and get that healthy drink going first thing in the morning. Mm-hmm. And stop that quivering, stop the voices in my head. And I would do it again. And that I would be like, oh, wow, I have to go to work soon and I have a broken nose. Well, let's tell them I was jumped at the Pike Market, which is like the most peaceful area in Seattle. But, you know, I use that excuse. Or, you know, those embarrassing times and getting beat up by two high school kids this month, too. I mean, that's always good to tell people. Pedaling bikes home and then someone says the wrong thing to someone, next thing you know, I have a broken eye socket and a concussion from a high school kid. And then I didn't want to press charges because I was drunk and, you know, I was like, I justify it, you know. Okay, well, it's maybe my fault. Maybe I shouldn't have been pedaling my bicycle through there. And, you know, they're high school kids. Maybe they'll change. And then what do I do when I get home? After the Norfolk Police Department, Fire Department leave, I can make a drink. And it keeps going and repeating itself. And I forget about all those times and all those fist fights. Or nice Valentine's Day, get a couple dozen roses, open, get pissed off, open the second story window, and bomb them right down to the sidewalk. Shatter glass on the pool. Simple, I'm sorry, I'll work the next morning. For me, anyways. I mean, I don't care what anyone else thinks. If I'm saying I'm sorry, I mean it. No questions asked. So if I'm saying I'm sorry, you need to get off my back the next day. And then I'll start drinking again and forget all about that. And it's just, it's a sad game. I couldn't even see myself. I was blind to it. So many times, I love a mirror. I never met a mirror I didn't like. And you'd think I would have saw that looking in so many mirrors, but, you know, I was obtuse to it. And I just kept looking over it and keep doing it, keep doing it, keep doing it. Thanks.
Thanks, you.
Just reminded me of one of my Valentine's days when I was drinking and I was dating the one, you know, the love of my life when I was 18. And it's funny, you know, not being able to bring into my mind with sufficient force the memory of the humiliation of even a day or a week or a month ago or whatever. That's how I drink, you know. It doesn't matter that the first time I got drunk, I took my clothes off on the side of the road and, you know, thought that some dog in a Burger King parking lot was mine and tried to take it home or, you know, any of that stuff because people were laughing, you know. And if people are laughing, then I belong, you know. I was the life of the party. You know, people... There are a lot of people that don't take their clothes off on the side of the road. I mean, maybe not many in this room, but there are a lot of people that don't do that. And those are not my people. And so, you know, here I am doing those kinds of things right away when I start drinking. So I go to college. I'm on the side of the road. I'm doing the drunk dance, talking to the cops. Oh, yeah, I live here. You know, I'm from Virginia. And they're like, just get her home. And, you know, the guys at the university began to take a special interest in me. You know, that made drinking free. Maybe some of y'all can relate to that. I don't know. And I did things that were humiliating. You know, I did things that I wasn't proud of. The value system that I was raised with did not apply when I was drinking. And so, you know, whether it was signing up for 15 credit hours and getting 9, you know, having to, you know, drop out of badminton, not being able to pass a photography class, showing up after having alcohol poisoning and vomiting every hour, on the hour, all night long, and going to the teacher and saying, and knowing I must have smelled like a bottle of Stoli's. You know, I must have just reeked. You know, it was one of those, I'm sure I was sweating it out like we do. But the next day, you know, wasn't so bad. You know, I remember the most humiliating thing ever was okay, you know, later. And I won't share that from here, but there are certain things that I did that I thought, wow, this is not, you know, this is not how my mama and daddy raised me. You know, this is not things that a lady does, maybe a lady of the night. but, you know, and there I was. And as embarrassed as I was, I couldn't see past that if the next day I could drink, you know, because then I can blot it out, you know. Talks in the book about accepting spiritual help or blotting out our consciousness, our intolerable situation, and that's what I did. And I can tell you that the insanity that I experience today is the same. You know, it may not be with regard to alcohol, but I still attempt to blot it out. I still try to manage my life and suffer from obsessions in my mind that will cause me to begin to act in certain ways that aren't very good. You know, I don't want to say they're bad. I don't know what's good or bad. But I suffer when I do those things. It's not even that I hurt other people. I do. But I suffer. And I don't want to do that anymore, you know. So the first step is just as relevant for me today as it was the day that I put down the drink. And I think there's been periods in my sobriety where I forgot that, or where I didn't hold that as near to my heart as I am right now. So I don't know what's next. Let's see.
Thank you.
Okay.
Page 34. For those who are unable to stop, for those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. We're assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. Whether such a person can quit on a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. Many of us felt we had plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever, yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it, this utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. How shall we help our readers determine to their own satisfaction whether they are one of us? The experiment of quitting drinking for a period of time will be helpful, but we think we can render an even greater service to alcoholic sufferers and perhaps to the medical fraternity. So we shall, one more cup of coffee, David. So we shall describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking, for obviously this is the crux of the problem. What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree which has brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy are mystified when he walks directly into a saloon. Why does he? Of what is he thinking? Jason?
I have, when I first, my first day of being sober, I didn't think any of that applied to me. Like, I still had that mindset, you know, I'm not an alcoholic, I just need this little break, and everything will go back to being normal. And I didn't really grasp anything in rehab either, besides watching people do what they do, and then being the same old person in there, but not drinking and judging. And it's like, I went into rehab not smoking, and I see people smoking in there, so I start pick back up smoking in rehab, well, because it was social hour, you got to go gossip in there. So of course I wanted to be a smoker, but even with them sending us to AA meetings, I really didn't have a clue at all. I just was like, okay, well, I'll do this and I'll do this. And until, I mean, when I popped out of treatment, the first place I went to was an AA meeting that night, and that's when I started to kind of put things, because I always had this bias against AA too, because it seemed like everyone had their own cliques. Like, you had the cool people, you had the goth people, and it had the cliques, just like in high school. We're like, okay, there's the preppy AA people, and there's the hippies. So I was biased even going in, and then, you know, someone spoke, and I related to it, and I was like, wow, that's exactly how I feel. And I didn't hesitate. I had a fear because, you know, it was keeping me sober, the fact that I didn't want to lose my career. And I got to give an FU to the military because I self-referred. I wasn't command-referred. So anything I did, once I said, I think I have a drinking problem, anything after that, you know, was fine because I got them. So I was like, haha, I got them. They couldn't get me. So I was happy with them. And it took me so long to even and do that, when they're like, one of the attorneys is like, do you think you have a drinking problem? I'm like, nah. She's like, well, I'll tell you this, the XO's on his way in to fry you. I'm like, yeah, maybe I do have a drinking problem. Only because it saved my ass. It was the only reason. And then, like I said, once I got out of rehab and went to the AA meeting and realized, you know, maybe that it's something that is not right with me. Why I can't stop, and I'm always thinking about drinking. And when I drink, you know, I can't stop. Or I think managing my time well is, you know, stop drinking by 10 o'clock at night, get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, and go work out in the steam room, and then go to work. Those people were still smelling it on me. You know how disappointing that is? You know how much time I waste in that steam room? So I had this mindset, you know. But like I said, I got a sponsor the first night, and, you know, just try to buckle down, and then reading through the big book and understanding, you know, maybe my mind's not right. I got tons of voices that run through there every single day, and it's just like, even today being sober, it's like, there's times where I just can't turn my mind off, and I just have to get out of my own head and you know, call someone, call a sponsee, call my sponsor, and it's, you know, I find I can be just as crazy in being sober as I was drinking, and just instead of, you know, craving alcohol, I can run on eBay and just start charging stuff like crazy, or Amazon and be like, oh, I do need like 15 different chargers for my tablet. I need different feet, you know, different plug-in. Oh, that doesn't work, you know. Okay, well, I need new t-shirt. I need this. So I can take my addiction, and even being sober, to shopping, sex, porn, you know, whatever, you name it, I want it. I want the next best thing. But, you know, nowadays I understand that I have that mind where, you know, some things aren't right, and I definitely should always run and buy someone else before, you know, checking in or checking out. And so for me, it was just like, I loved the fact this program, you know, it took me a while to understand that whole mentality thing, the mindset, you know. But once I did, I started seeing more. Now I look back on it and I'm like, wow, how did I not see that? Everyone else could see it but me. And it's like, you know, I knew how to work people to the point where I had a lot of people be like, oh, I didn't know you had a drinking problem. I never seen you drink too much. Damn right, didn't it? Because I hid it from you. And all those Gatorade bottles, it wasn't just Gatorade. That's why you drink Gatorade and vodka. It's healthy for you. That's all I got. Thanks.
What kind of thinking precedes the first drink? Some of my favorites are, I deserve this. I've been good for so long, you know, 15 minutes. That's a long time. You know, I'll get away with it this time. These are some of the little lies that I've told myself. Some of the big lies, too, you know. Doesn't really matter what I do. I don't matter here. Sometimes I've even thought that sober and Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, they don't, you know, who cares? I don't really have anything to do with this. It doesn't matter anyway, you know. I might as well take a drink. So my mind tells me lies, a lot of lies. And I just recently had an experience where a lot of those lies were building up. And I didn't just come to Alcoholics Anonymous yesterday, okay? It's not like I just showed up here, okay? I've been sober for a little while, and I still have an alcoholic mind that will tell me lies. And I have an alcoholic mind that will believe every single one of them. And then what happens is, what happens if they go away? What will happen if they go away? What happens when the lie you've been believing your whole life goes away? You know, some pretty heavy shit right there. You know, caused me to cry, let's put it that way. And I hate crying. I would rather do anything but cry. But what was really awesome was this just happened like 2 weeks ago. It was that really warm day we had, and I'm walking around the park in Chesapeake crying my eyes out over this, what's going to happen when the lies go away. And I realized that it was just like when I was drinking. Only instead of walking around the beautiful campus with a glass of wine, I'm walking around with my, you know, cell phone listening to Mark Ronson crying. I don't know what's going on here. That's the happiest music in the world, and I'm bawling my eyes out. That's who I am. And my mind is not always clear. You know, I can't control my drinking. I think I deserve it. I think if people treated me a certain way, everything would be wonderful, like it talks about in the third step. And the only relief that I had from that before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous was to drink. When I was drinking, I had an incredible amount of unspoken, unreal pressure on myself. And I don't know if any of y'all can relate to that or not, but I just felt like I was under so much pressure. My parents weren't putting any pressure on me, but I would have sworn in the Bible that they were. My sister wasn't putting any pressure on me. Professors weren't demanding anything of me, but I was under pressure. I was like that song, ready. I was stretched out as taut as a, you know, a rubber band, ready to ping off anywhere, and alcohol brought that, relieved that tension. And so when I experienced that in sobriety, it doesn't go away as quickly as when I'm drinking. So it's harder, you know, it's harder to deal with at times. But I knew in the moment that I was walking around the park and saw the similarity between the two, that like Bill Wilson said, how dark it is before the dawn. I'm just being prepared for something. I don't know what it is. I wish I did. There's the truth again. So, but it's, you know, it's okay today. But my mind tells me lies. And that's the insane thinking I have before I take a drink, is that it'll be different, I deserve it, if only, you know, if only I just, that's one of those tricky words too, I just want one little thing, like a shot of vodka. Anyway, I want a shot of vodka in my life. Okay.
We're going to continue on 41. We're in the section of the book where we meet a couple of different guys. We meet the jaywalker. We meet the whiskey and milk guy. We meet the guy who crosses the threshold and says, you know what, I think I'll have a highball before dinner. So this paragraph doesn't really make sense standing by itself, but it's got some important ideas. Anyway, page 41. As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over that evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time, I had not thought of the consequences at all. I had commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. Mm-hmm. I now remembered what my alcoholic friends had told me, how they prophesized that I had an alcoholic mind. The time and place would come, I would drink again. They said that though I did raise a defense, it would one day give way before some trivial reason for having a drink. Well, just that did happen, and more. For what I had learned of alcoholism did not occur to me at all. I knew from that moment that I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots. I had never been able to understand people who said that a problem had them hopelessly defeated. I knew then it was a crushing blow. Jason?
I was happy to learn that when they said they classified me as having alcohol, or they classified me as alcohol dependent. So, you know, it was great to have a classification finally, and to be like, I fit in. And my mindset was, you know, like I said earlier, never thought I was, and never thought about the whole brain thing. I thought, you know, everyone has those thoughts of, you know, of the voices going on up there. We all want everything, at least I did. I wanted what you had, or even better, to go rub in your face. But when I got the classification of knowing, okay, well, you know, you're not alone, and, you know, there's a lot of people, of coming into AA and understanding, okay, well, I'm not alone, or you hear someone speak and they talk, you know, and it's like, all right, well, they just said it out loud, so maybe I'm not that crazy. I was thinking that too. And then you hear that, and it starts to make me feel more at home, because, you know, I'm not the only one in my crazy thinking. And it was that was a great feeling to come to terms with that. And it made me to feel better and welcomed, and, you know, finally have some peace of being like, okay, well, there's more than meets the eye to this disease, and you know, that's when I really wanted to buckle down and start figuring out, you know, what I can do to make myself better, and making sure that I took the right steps, and making sure that I wanted it, because ultimately I have to want it. No one else can want it for me. Well, they can, but, you know, that doesn't mean it gets done. And I had to take this head on myself, and, you know, there was times there was times in the beginning where I was discouraging and it felt like it was worth nothing or I wasn't going to get anything out of it. But, you know, that's my selfish thinking, too. It's like, what am I going to get out of this for getting sober? What is the Coast Guard going to give me? What are my parents going to give me for getting sober? What are you going to give me for getting sober? And until I let go of all those wanting things and, you know, except for the wanting it myself, it seemed like I really wanted it for myself. And I did want it for myself. And when I sat down and got rid of all those selfish thoughts and actually took it face on, it started to bring some peace to me and wanting to continue and wanting to be able to share the message. I can remember not even being through the steps and had, was told, you know, help the newcomer. What can I do? I'm not even through the steps. Welcome them. Welcome them like you were welcome. I'm like, you sure you want me to do that? Or, you know, helping with anything in the meeting, getting a service position, even making coffee or just showing up and even showing up at home for, you know, my family, my ex-wife, being kind of nice to her. But, you know, I've always, I loved taking on my ex-wife, especially on nights where I had a few drinks. Not physically, but I love to argue. I loved even more, like, if you say something, I'm gonna nuke what I'm gonna say, and I'm gonna give it to you. So it just blows you right off the face of the earth. And, you know, I still do that today sober, especially on the way here. She blew up on me, and I think I maintained some peace, but, you know, I think for me with my ex-wife, I think she's always going to be on my resentment list, and nothing's going to change that. All I can do is, you know, appreciate, try to help her, and not myself, and not be selfish. That's all I got.
I love all those people in the big book, like Jim and Fred and the Jaywalker, because I am all those guys. You know, Jim minimizes his frustration and drives out into the country to sell a car. Who the hell does that? Our friend Jim, you know. I'll just have a little whiskey and milk and I'll be fine. You know, there you go. There's that idea. My boss is getting on my nerves. I deserve it. Whiskey and milk. I'll get away with it this time. You know. And then I've been like the other guy. You know. In the tuxedo. I love the picture of that in like the 30s. Some guy getting dressed up in some white jacketed black pants, tuxedo, looking all fancy, smoking a cigarette, doing his hair, you know. What's the hobo? You know, everything's going great, you know. I've suffered from both of those. And I'm the jaywalker, you know. I think if I have a headache, I'll just hit myself in the head with a hammer and it'll go away. You know, I have those kinds of thoughts. I know, it's so funny, my alcoholic mind, when I was drinking, I didn't even know I had an alcoholic mind, you know, and that's awesome, because then I'm not even aware of it. All I know is I want to drink, you know, just get out of my way and let me have a drink. I got one thing to think about, and we're good, you know, I'm going to get drunk. So you take that away, and suddenly I'm sober. Oh, Jesus, I still want to drink, right, for a while, just thinking about the drink. And then that goes away. God removes the obsession to drink from me. And suddenly there are people around me that I can become obsessed with. So let me think about you 23 hours a day and how you should treat me. Let me think about that new computer that I need so bad for 23 hours a day. Hell, let me go home and just put on Netflix and watch three seasons of The Wire for 23 hours a day. You know, I'll do whatever it takes to try to settle down the mind. You know, you're talking about buying chargers for your thing. I've bought cars and strange metal light bulbs, spot sober. I've bought laptops. You know, one day I went to MacArthur Mall just to look. Here I come with a suitcase with a computer in it, like the box is shaped like a suitcase, and okay, you know, these things happen. I have no thought of the consequences, you know, and even when I do, I don't listen. You know, I can remember, and this is a really dumb example, but I can remember my freezer in my apartment freezing all up, and it had like this little freezer compartment inside the refrigerator. I lived in a little apartment. It was all covered in ice, and I thought, you know, I should do something to get this undone. So I go get tools. I don't know how to use tools, but I got them. And so I think I'm just going to undo these things. And I'm thinking this probably isn't a good idea. But I do it anyway. And then the freezer doesn't work, and there was a hair dryer involved, and there was a lot of water, and things were a mess, you know. And that is what I do with my life, you know. I think I got tools. You know, I rarely think to pick up the spiritual toolkit. I always think to pick up the material toolkit. You know, I need more money, more sex, more job, more work, more men, more whatever. You know, I'm not thinking, oh yeah, I need more prayer and meditation and God. No. But when I do that, really cool things start to happen. You know, so I just have to be mindful of the kind of tools that I'm using. Because I've tried to solve my alcoholic mind problem with damn near everything. And the only thing that really seems to work is the steps and God and you guys and being a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. But my insane thinking tells me you've been here long enough, you should know better. You know, maybe you need to do this instead. It worked at the beginning, but it's not going to work now. You know, I get crazy ideas. My mind doesn't work right. That thing at the beginning where it talks about suffering from a hopeless state of mind and body, you know, that means I have a mind that doesn't work right and a body that won't die. So I am trapped with this alcoholic mind and this body that's not going to die. And sometimes I just tell it, you know, you're a bully. Leave me alone, you know. My body says, if you, you know, I'm here to house you. Like, you know, and I talk to myself sometimes. I know it's crazy. But, hey, I didn't drink today. You know, I'm at a meeting. I'm doing things that don't seem like they're going to work. And they're working. So sometimes I just have to practice doing the thing I don't want to do because that's what I need to do. You know, I can no longer decide. I can't pick and choose anymore. I can't take AA a la carte, which is a bummer. You know, I gotta have the vegetables and not just the Jell-O. So, I'm really glad to be here. Thanks.
Thanks, Nicole. All right, we're out of time for sharing. We'll let Bill Wilson have the last word on page 43. Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. All right, we're going to pass the seven tradition basket. Seven tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seven tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. Are there any announcements for the good of AA tonight? Go.
I'm Sarah, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sarah. Hey, Sarah.
There's a new meeting on Friday nights in Virginia Beach with babysitting. I don't know the name of it. I know it's a literature-based meeting. It's at King's Grant Presbyterian, 745 Little Neck Road, if you want to know more. But a babysitting meeting's there Thursday night and Friday night, 7 o'clock. So if you need babysitting meetings, let me know. I'll give you more information.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Any other announcements? This group, the Simple Actions Group, we've got these attractive yellow flyers, hopefully on the literature table back there. Mark your calendars for Friday, March 20th, and Saturday, March 21st. Bob D. from Las Vegas and Valerie D. from Richmond, Virginia are going to be here on Friday night, the 20th. Talking on various topics starting at 6:30, and then we'll resume again on Saturday morning at 9 a.m. We'll have you out of here by 2:30 p.m. There's a potluck lunch in the middle of all of that. There's no registration fee or cost of any kind associated with this event. All are welcome to attend. It's absolutely free. Potluck lunch, though, we'd ask you to bring a dish if you wish. And again, there's flyers all around. But come on out, please. Enjoy that with us. Okay. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. All right. And newcomers, you are the reason we are here. Is there anybody here in their first 30 days of sobriety that could just... First name?
Sarah, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Sarah. Welcome.
Hi, Mary.
Mary, welcome.
Welcome.
Hey, Rebecca, I'm alcoholic.
Hi, Rebecca.
Hey, Rebecca. Welcome, welcome.
Welcome. Anybody else? All right, there is literature available. It is over yonder. This is yonder. Over here. In that direction. Please see a home group member if you'd like to buy a book. Sponsorship. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. Would anyone willing to be a sponsor, please raise your hand. And if you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, it's a no contract deal. We've got a couple of members from the home group will be up here. Evan and Debbie will be up at the table after the meeting. If you want to just ask, hey, what's a sponsor? Tell me more. Please feel free to come talk to them. Smokers, please use the butt can provided outside and stay well away from the church doors. There are other people using the facility. We don't want to smoke them all up. All the meetings here are recorded, and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. If you'd like to be included on our email list, you can sign up on the website or the literature table. There's a place to sign up. I think I covered everything. Can we thank the panel again? I'd like to thank everyone who participated, and after we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the step discussed tonight at the meeting, after the meeting, which is going to be held in this boutique Mexican place on 22nd and Colonial. It's called Plaza del Sol. We're all going there tonight after about a year. They had a fire or something. But we're all going back there tonight, so please feel free. Would anybody like to read the last two paragraphs on page 164? Go, Sarah. Is there nothing she can't do?
Okay, I'm Sarah. I'm an alcoholic.
Sarah.
Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows.
clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thanks for letting me read.
Thanks for reading. Thank you.
Shall we close with the Lord's Prayer?
Bring it in.
They're like, we're not moving.
You move.
You move. We're not moving.
We all connected? Need to pray.
Our Father.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Amen.